morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. We're going to open, as usual, with Legba, performed by Zion Trinity. And then we're going to surprise you with an episode from the archives. Enjoy.
Barasuayo.
So I was wondering if you could tell me about the ensemble, Hun, Her, Too, and the type of music that you perform. If you could maybe tell us a little bit about sort of where you all are from and the uniqueness of the place and the type of music that you perform. A lot of people know it as throat singing.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's just we are from the real Central Asia. It is called Tuva. It's or Orian region. This is old ancient name of our nationality and our region, Orians. And we are musicians, yes, of course, and we are playing our traditional songs mostly. It's kind of 90% is kind of our traditional songs, sometimes composed by Kagalo, our oldest man.
Mm-hmm.
And just mostly we play our ancient traditional songs. And also represent our throat singing style. We have three main throat singing styles, kind of, and some another two, three kind of soup styles. It's mixed together with this style. What I'm telling you, also we are playing with our ancient traditional instruments. We are recovering. We are make it like 1,000 years ago. Make it like our makers, old people. Make it by Siberian larch tree, by skin, mountain goat skin, and by horse's hair, make it for strings, horse's hair, make it for the bow. And you have strings instruments and like a drum, or some percussion, horse's hoof, and kengerge, it's like low, big drum. It's like Lamaist shaman, Lamaist Buddhist drum. And these anchovies have traditional instruments. Some flute also have, we are calling this flute shawl. It's mostly our songs. Is.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we are still nomads. We are singing about many songs about the horse, about the nature, about our style of life. You know,
mm-hmm.
Life of,
I remember. You actually within the song, the co-founder, because it says that you are a co-founder of Hun Her Too. The music. I mean, you make the sounds of the birds within the song, and I'm like, wow, and it just sounds just like the birds. It's so beautiful, and I was reading that. The music that, it has a spiritual context, and it also has a revolutionary context, too, because you would tell us, well, this is a song, that's sort of looking at, our nation and our sovereignty and all that. I wonder if you could talk about sort of the spirituality of the piece, of the work, because I believe that your drummer is a shaman. So, and then Sasha was showing us, you know, the instruments that, you know, some of the rattles that were made out of different parts of the animal's body. I wonder if you could talk about sort of the spirituality that sort of runs through the type of music that you perform, and also how present it is insofar as speaking to the political situation and what's going on within the community, past and present.
Why we are singing this type of songs, like international revolution song, it's just, also kind of try to represent what kind of history in our country.
Mm.
It's our country is very kind of old place for the many of civilizations, you know. It's just Turkic Khaganate, Kyrgyz Kazakh Khaganate, many of places in this place. Start for the many of civilization and many of the governments, you know. We still have now around the world, it's like Turkey country or like another time. Our language is go around the world also. It's, many people in special in Russia place and around the Central Asia speaking like in our, with our language.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of old historical place. From the thousands of years ago, this is some kind of empire there, different type of empire. And so in 1970, we are just starting like in Russia. Russia brought to the tour some kind of revolution energy. And people start to thinking, how this try to kind of for better life for poor people, make it kind of together, kind of commune life, and try to be. And it's not easy for everybody. It's changing mind, changing religion. You know, this is killing many shamans, killing musicians, and have some destructible, absolutely kind of things of doing this time revolution. Also have a good point for the poor people who start to another life, you know, start to make it together, better life. And why we are singing like this song, it's called international. Like, if we are together, if we have friendship with another nation, it is better for future, like this, you know. And it's mostly that. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm listening.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was looking at, the different bios in your current piece, your current CD, Ancestors Call, and you played quite a few of those at the concert at the Great American Music Hall in San Francisco, and I was just reading about one of the oldest member of the group. How do you pronounce his name?
Kygo.
Yeah. That he actually was a shepherd until the age of 21.
Yes.
And then,
right.
And that's when he was invited to join the Tuvan State Ensemble. And And you're younger than he is, and you're bicultural. Your father is Tuvan, and your mother is Russian.
Right.
And so you had a different type of rearing. You went to study in the Northern Caucasus.
Yeah,
and you play, the fretless bass. You played in the Russian jazz rock band.
Yeah.
So you sort of come, and you've also, played folk rock band. And so you come to the ensemble with sort of, a different type of palette, and maybe some of the other members do as well. It's like Radic, perhaps, because he's your younger member. So I was wondering if you could talk about the ensemble and the music that you play. But maybe you could talk about this Ancestors Call and the type of music that made it onto this particular project.
Okay, I think like how I play this different type of music,
mm-hmm.
some kind of some I miss something, you know, that in how I'm starting it. We are playing with Heigl always like early 80s, end of 70s, early 80s. We are playing still together, like ethno rock ensemble. After that, we are divorced, and like I'm going to study music in college, and she also played with another ensemble. So we are meeting again in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. We are just thinking, maybe try to kind of find it more deeper with real instruments, try to make it instruments, and try to understand what it means, a real ancient sound.
Mm.
And we are making the instruments, and also talk with all these people who in this time is early 19th, still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now mostly dead, you know, this is, and we are start to ask and we start to discuss and start to want to understand what it means, old, ancient type of our music. Why this time, I'm stop listening anything and all this music, I'm stop playing this jazz or jazz rock or bass,
mm-hmm.
I'm just make it empty, my spirit empty, my mind. You know, and try to understand like through from the my sound, from the my instruments, and after that, you know, find it exactly something new, old and new, you know,
mm-hmm.
and better for our music understand each other, just by spirit, you know, this by instruments, as we are helping our traditional ancient style of playing. It's like jam session now in the between the jazz musicians, you know,
mm-hmm.
and many our oldest people play it. Make some ensemble, not so much. It's like family ensemble who in your family who plays, and you make it and improvise around the one kind of standard. You know, it's like one song, our song, and each other have some one chorus, and just another chorus, another guy singing and talking lyrics, and play with different instruments and just around the melody, just improvise and make it most beautiful how possible. This kind of one of the point of our music, and one of the kind of, for me, this I like very much. That's how we are played together. We are still
mm-hmm.
strong and still find it deepest emotional by words, emotional by instruments, good instruments make it now. This helps us moving forward,
mm-hmm.
and looking back and moving forward.
Right, yeah, and also it, you know, the music, it really transports us, you know, the audience, you know, to different places. I mean, you know, when you did the different pieces with the horses,
yeah,
we felt like we were there. It's like, wow. And
welcome.
Then, yeah, it's really beautiful. And then when, you know, the really quiet ones, and we sort of following the birds.
Yeah.
That was like so beautiful.
Yeah, this was very important. As you tell, it's good work, it's transporting.
Mm-hmm.
As we are also transporting with you together.
Oh.
We are transporting to home.
Mm-hmm.
We are transporting by lyrics, you know, that can give it some inside our mind, kind of visual picture,
mm-hmm.
about what is we are thinking about the mountains or kind of hills or steps. You just close your eyes, you feel it by words, and it's kind of make it visual in your, because for the musician, it's like you make it visual. After that, they see it some more and understand exactly what we are doing and what we are wanting.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah, you know, your string instrument, that I think most of you all had a version of it, but some of them had little horses on the top part. And those are really interesting. What instrument is that?
Yeah, this is it is why this is have old kind of story telling story about how grow up our instruments,
mm-hmm.
how this kind of born from, you know, we have two stories how this. You talk about the EGIL, it is IGIL, it's instruments,
yes.
It's kind of with bows, and kind of two strings, horse's hair strings and skin, and make it by wood.
Mm-hmm.
These instruments grow up from the one of the storytellers, like came from the spirit, by horse from the sky. We have story legend. I don't know if you find it somewhere. It's it's a little bit long story. Yeah. And why this right make it this kind of top of the instruments horse? This is mostly this kind of this instrument about the spirit of horse or reincarnation of horse, you know?
Wow, that's interesting. So the instrument within itself, it has a vibration because of the spirit that.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. Wow. And I was just looking, you know, when people think about, you know, Tuva, and then you look it up and it says that the republic is situated in the far south of Siberia. And I'm like, wow, you know, you think about Siberia, and that's far. I mean, like,
yeah.
You know, they have, like, sayings about, you know, sort of going to Siberia, like, that's as far as you can go. That's like going to the North Pole almost. So Siberia, and it's the center of Asia. So what's it like there? Is there a lot of open land, or is it industrialized like the rest of the world? What's it look like there?
It's real beautiful. I travel around the world. I tell you, this is not like just I have this honor for my country. It's like it's different to one of the most beautiful places in the world. It's wild. It has this kind of very strange and unusual situation by the climatic, by the weather, by the different landscape, you know. We have around the two mountains, big high mountains. It's like 4,000 meters high or 2,000, 3,000. It's around the Tuva. It's ring. Exactly, it's definitely ring. Inside, we have different landscape. It's mountains or somebody inside is kept little desert or many mountain steps, and it's more deep it have just step, and rivers, lakes, deep forest, taiga, tundra. It is many of kind of different landscape. It is animals also. You see this in our country, close to each other, it's like 100 miles between. It's been just northern deer and camels. You know, camels, it is from the desert. You see this? We have exactly another camels like in Mongolia. It's with big hair.
Mm-hmm.
Is it in the winter still alive? It's like, it's impossible, you know. It's like, if you see it just in the map, in the middle of Central Asia, have just our republic, where it has northern deer and camels.
Mm-hmm.
And many of another kind of unusual animals from different parts of Intua. It's like all together just in one place. And this kind of explains you why this is a very strange climatical and landscape.
Yeah. And I think I've because men aren't the only ones that do the throat singing. And what if you could talk about how you sing, like that resonance that comes from your throat up and out, and you have like these really different pitches. I mean, different members of your group have different tonal kind of pitches, and then you all, you know, sort of, you know, we'd have different solos, you know, we were listening to you perform. And I was wondering sort of how do you do that? Like, do all Tuva Republic citizens know how to sing like that because that's just what you do, or is it like special? You have to go to school, or you have to have a grandfather or a great grandmother, whatever. How do people come up knowing how to sing like that, and how do you do that?
Okay, this is a good question. This is mostly, you know, this is now last 15 years. We have some have kind of school for the teaching this stuff.
Okay.
And before, no, it is before. It's like how we are learning. We are learning from the YouTube's fruits. We have to learn from the grandfather, from the father, from the uncle, from the brothers, another from the cousins who are singing around you. Mm-hmm. It's kind of man honor, you know, man, how men, the same like small guy, this, he want to be sitting horse and driving, you know. The same how he hears this voice, he want to sing like father, like brother, you know. This is like man, man try to do it. How the first time listen, it's so beautiful, so expressional, some emotional, I don't know why. It's my friend, it's learned from the grandfathers and fathers. Me too, you know, this is around me, this many of my cousins who do it well. And now this, we are trying to explain for young generation how we are learning this, like make it easy. It's before, you know, you just, you don't have license from the old people. You just do it, and time after time, years to the years, after that you maybe start to understand what it means for singing. And it's now easy for kind of have music education, kind of talking for the young generation, what it means, how it's going, something like that.
Yeah. So is it just man to man or boy man to boy or?
Yeah, right.
So also the women don't sing this style.
No. This is now start to sing. It's before years. Before we have taboo about this. You know, this is woman don't sing like that style. A woman have this another voice, beautiful kind of style of singing, like normal, like it's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Not throat singing like usual normal, but beautiful woman voice singing and play with many of instruments, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's just forbidden like this throat singing is. Now this last 20 years, young generation of girls it's like start to do it something.
Okay. Oh, interesting. Oh, so it's shifting. The tradition is shifting now.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Are you all happy with that?
No. No, you know, this is kind of, for us, it's a little bit weird stuff, you know. We are just remember why this taboo, this, we are sometimes asking all these people, you know, why this taboo. It's this woman needed fertility, woman needed baby, you know. This energy, how we are doing, it's not good for the kind of, we are produced so high frequency, so low frequency, it's making vibration. It's not good for woman, just for, you know, for stomach. Woman need to be softer and, like, not used to produce kind of this sound.
Mm-hmm.
It is make it bad psychical mind for the baby, for the fertility, for, you know, this is kind of you make it tension in your pressure, in your stomach, in your chairs. It is, I think it's a little bit through. It's taboo. It's not just, you know, like taboo for future, I don't know.
Yeah.
Why we are not so happy. It's okay. We are hearing this. Yeah, it's okay. Only just we are worried about these girls who are doing this, you know.
Right. We have to check in another maybe 10 years and see where it is.
Yeah. In our life, we see what is happening, you know. If you find it, it means call it Tivakazi group. If you find it now easily, I think it is something where website, maybe have this, or in the computer, or this something.
Okay. Oh, spell it for me. How do you spell it?
Tiva, T-U-V-A-K-Z-I, T-U-V-U-K-Z-I. It's, I don't know how it's later English is.
Okay.
K-Z-I. It means two-one girls.
Oh, two-one girls. Okay, I'll find it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. I've got two more questions. First is the meaning of the ensemble Hun Her Too. What does that mean? And then the last one is how did you all meet each other? Like how did you meet the co-founder?
Okay. Oh, this Hun in our language, in Turkic ancient language, Hun means son.
Oh.
Her Too means kind of Her Too like propeller, like turning of rise of sun.
Mm-hmm.
Like after the clouds, you see sometimes you beautiful effect is after the clouds, or if you go deep forest and they're up in the tree. Sunrise going and a little bit moving. Mm-hmm. Not staying, it's like moving and turning mm-hmm. around the woods or around the around the, what is the clouds.
Mm-hmm.
After the clouds is going sunrise. Just beautiful things. We have many of them in Tuvalu. See, we have them like ringed by mountains and kind of clouds a little bit shadow and sometimes moving and some going up or down. It's making this beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. That's nice.
Yes, mm-hmm. Interesting, right? And another, your question is just,
how did the four of you all meet each other? Yeah, how did you meet?
Yeah.
How did you meet the co-founder, and then how did you get the other members?
Yeah, we have met with co-founder, as I told you before. This we are 1979. We are started going together 78, 79.
Okay.
And after that divorce, we are the time go to Russia. Some make education music college, and we are meet again in 1991. My brother, who lives now in here, United States, he just make it and plan. Again, try to make it some music. After that, in 1993, we are involved, we are inviting to our group, it's our drummer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and start to play this. After that, we have been in four, and Anatoly Kulor. After that, it's Anatoly Kulor gone. It's another guy come to our group, it's Andrei Mangush. He play also 2 years, a little bit more, maybe. And after that, we are finding a good musician from the another group called Yatsa. He played before there. It's Radik.
He
played before there. We are inviting him. This is how this our place is MJ Andre. It is also going to to another group in Tuva. It's Tuva National Orchestra. He played there now.
Mm-hmm.
And Radik enjoy us. It's like we are playing together now more than 6 years.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah. Well, next time you'll have to teach us how to dance, because we know there's a dance to it, but we didn't know how to do it. So, like, we need to be up there dancing, like, because I would love to know how to dance to the music you were playing, because I'm sure it's just as lovely as the music.
Yeah, yeah. There's some people dancing around our music. Some make it. We have different dancing samples to who just ask it all the time our music for the dancing. Yeah, okay, we are just happy about that. It's good for people who like to dance with this music.
Because you know how you introduced all the songs, you could like, okay, and this is how you dance to this one.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, cool. How much longer are you here in the United States before you leave to go elsewhere in your tour?
No, we are go from the Cedar Rapids and we are go to the Pittsburgh, and 4th October we are came back to Moscow and do a concert in Moscow and go home.
Okay.
Yeah.
So have you had a good tour so far?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We have success and very good.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you so much for visiting us, in San Francisco and for this lovely interview. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Okay.
Every good question, yes.
Sure. And what I'll do is...
Thank you.
Well, that was the group Hun Her Too, and the piece was called Prayer. And if you enjoyed the conversation with the member of the ensemble, that was, gosh, I think I did that interview quite a while ago. they are going to be in Oregon in September at the Alberta Rose Theater, which is located at 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland, Oregon. So that's not too far if you're on the Pacific West Coast. You just travel north, and Oregon's not that far. And they are certainly worth it. September 24th is a Sunday. So you can get tickets, I believe, and be engaged and enjoy the music of Hun Her Too. I'm going to close this particular part of the program with Prayer. And these are all from, these pieces are both from their album that they had at that particular time. The name is escaping me right at the moment. I'm not certain what the name of that particular album is. I think it was called Ancestors Call, I believe. It's really, really awesome. And I also put on the website a concert that was when Hun Her Too were in Berkeley, and it's an hour and 18 minutes. It's really nice. And it was just uploaded. So that should be really cool. That's a 2008 concert. So you will really enjoy that. You can hear them perform. So, like I said, that particular interview was from 2012, 4 years ago. And I'm gonna play another one of theirs. It's called Ancestors. We have a lot of folks that have made their transition here in the San Francisco Bay Area and elsewhere. Monica Pree made her transition last month on the 26th of June. Brother Kaleofas Williams made his transition last month as well. He was the president of the ILWU here in San Francisco. He was 93, and he did a whole lot for the union here. Kamal Amin-Ra, he made his transition last month, a wonderful photographer, arts activist, and curator. And I'm trying to think, and then, you know, Muhammad Ali and others, if we sort of reflect on the months and the years past, and then not to mention the two men who were taken a lot too soon last week through police violence. So we're gonna play Ancestors for those particular people, but for all of our ancestors and the yet to be born. Thank you. So that was Hunt Her 2 from their CD Ancestors Call, and that was Ancestors. And we were speaking to Sayan Bapa, a member of Hunt Her 2, and again, they're going to be in Oregon in September, September 24th. So you might want to get your tickets and go check them out. So I was thinking about playing an interview with Tim Wise. And I saw a couple of other songs that I was thinking about playing before I played that pre-recorded interview with Tim Wise. Recorded it a while ago. It was good. And you know, always topical, certainly always topical. And looking for this piece by Pope Flynn, a member of the ensemble on this particular CD, it's called The Africans Are Coming. it's called Sankofa Groove, Africans Are Coming. And I wanted to play a cut from that and wanted to let folks know that we want to keep Ni'ama in the light. He is in the hospital right now in ICU. They're trying to figure out what's going on with him. And so far, they don't know. So I want to hold him in the light while they try to, you know, run tests and things like that and figure it out. And you know how it is when you are talking and can't remember the alphabet. I'm talking about the English alphabet. Like, what comes first, S or P? So anyway, I found it. So there's a piece called Praise Him that I think is pretty nice. And so I'm going to play that, and then we're going to go into the interview with Tim Wise.
Oh,
that's Sankofa group. The Africans are coming, and again, you are tuned into Wanda's Picks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And we are going to close with an archived interview with Tim Wise. It was recorded in March of 2012. Your new book, Dear White America, Letter to a New Minority, it sort of continues your, you know, the type of writing and type of issues that you bring up, this truth-telling and soul-searching kind of writing, and that you do around exploration of a white skin privilege and structural racism and things like that. And I was wondering why this book now. I mean, all the books are personal, but this is a really personal one, similar to your first book, White Like Me.
Well, you know, as I was thinking about the sort of current political moment, and of course I had written Colorblind most recently, and it was a much more sort of analytical and I'm not going to say academic book, but it was much more about, you know, analysis and research and you know, heavily footnoted and really more about sort of developing a more intellectual theory, which was fine. I mean, it certainly was a valuable and I think is a valuable book, but I started to notice that in the last, you know, year to two since I'd really sat down to write the previous book, there had just been a much more, nasty edge of racism and racial commentary developing in the country, and a lot more personal, if you will, reaction to the current moment on the part of a lot of white Americans. And as I began to think about why that was happening, I also began to think about what it would take to respond to it. And it seemed to me that, and really all the evidence, research evidence actually says this too, is that at the end of the day, what gets people to honestly reflect on issues like race or anything that's at all controversial is not so much a bunch of facts and figures and studies as it is really, you know, to the point, personal kinds of reflection. And so in the current moment, what I identified or tried to identify were a few current trends that I think are sort of propelling a lot of this white racial anxiety forward in the current moment. And I identified four of them. One, of course, is the election of a black president, which for some folks challenges their notion of what leaders are supposed to look like, particularly when that president has what many consider an exotic name, an exotic background, you know, a father who's actually from Africa, not even African American, grew up in Hawaii, which for a lot of white folks is still just a tourist destination. I think they still don't really see it as an honest-to-God state. The second, of course, is the economic meltdown. So you have white folks for the first time in three generations being confronted by a level of economic security that we're not used to. And then we've got a popular culture, which has quite shifted in the last 25 to 30 years. You know, it was 25 years ago or so that MTV wouldn't even play videos by black artists except for Michael Jackson. And now we have a popular culture that's thoroughly interwoven across racial and ethnic lines, which challenges, I think, the normalcy that white Americans had long taken for granted with regard to, you know, our ability to at least control the cultural look of America. And then the final thing, and maybe the biggest, of course, is the demographic shift in the U.S. so that within, you know, 25 years, as we know, 30 years, half the population will be folks of color, half will be white. So the ability of white Americans to sort of assume that we are the prototype of an American, that we are the textbook definition of an American, is being challenged on all of those levels, economic, political, cultural, and even purely numerical or demographic. And so what that means is that for the first time, really, whiteness is being made visible to white people. It's always been visible to people of color, but to white folks, we've been able to sort of hide in our own skin, if you will, and not have to think about ourselves as a racialized people. And once we have now begun to see that that's not true, that we have a racial identity as well, and that it means something, that it has historically meant privilege, that it still does, and that it's being challenged, that creates a lot of anxiety. And the question that I'm trying to address in this book is, which direction will we go with that anxiety? Will we turn to more solidarity with people of color so as to diminish our anxiety, or will we react by circling the wagon, so to speak, and trying to hold on to that diminishing privilege at great risk I think, to ourselves and to the country.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And when I saw the title of the book, I thought of James Baldwin's letter to his nephew, The Fire Next Time, and I wondered, were you at all influenced in the style of this particular book and this particular message by that historic document? And it's just brilliant. And this book is small enough to almost put in one's pocket.
Right.
And it's, you know, as you said, you sort of lay it out in the beginning of the book that it wasn't going to be scholarly. You didn't want people to have to be, you know, flipping to the back of the chapter and looking at the notes.
Right.
If they want the notes, they can look at the end of the book.
Right.
And so you want it to be really accessible. And you said also that you're probably preaching to the choir.
Right.
But then you say choirs need to rehearse, and I
right.
thought, oh, that's so true. Even the best ones, they have rehearsals.
Right, right. Well, you know, I honestly, if I could have done this book without notes at all,
mm-hmm.
without any kind of note structure, I would have. And the only reason, of course, that I opted for the style that I did, which was basically just having that back section where I, you know, repeat part of a paragraph and then I tell you where that came from, is because I realize that, unfortunately, we are so uninformed when it comes to these issues that people won't believe you. You know, if you say something factual about racism in the justice system, there will be folks who just simply will not believe it. So I had to put something in there, but I did want it to read like a letter, and obviously you don't have footnotes in a letter, you know, so I had to sort of compromise a little bit on the style, but not too much. Certainly Baldwin's letter to his nephew was in my mind as I was thinking through the process. Baldwin, more than any writer, living or dead, has influenced me both in terms of how I think about race and how I try to write about race. So it was a combination of that, which I found to be, of course, you know, back in at the time that it was written, an incredibly effective, I guess that was 63, an incredibly effective way to convey the thoughts that Baldwin had at that time. And I also, of course, was piggybacking on this trend of the last 5 or 6 years, where you've had lots of authors, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, Naomi Klein, I think, did one, and then even Dinesh D'Souza on the right, you know, doing these books, Letter to a blah, 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 whatever it is. You know, I think Christopher Hitchens did Letter to a Young Contrarian, and Dinesh D'Souza did Letter to a Young Conservative, and Sam Harris did Letter to a Christian Nation. He's, you know, one of the sort of new atheist theorists. And so I think that trend of trying to make your point in the form of sort of an open letter is a pretty effective rhetorical tool. You know, it sort of gets you out of the mode of doing pure memoir or biography, which of course I did in White Like Me, my first book. It also gets you out of the mode of doing a purely academic thing. And I think to some extent it allows you to really speak to people the way that you would speak to them. And it makes it hopefully readable. You know, I've read some of those other letter books, if you will, and they tend to be pretty readable. And they're short, you know, they don't have to be long. And I didn't want this to be long. I wanted it to be punchy. I wanted it to provide the choir with the, you know, sort of rhetorical devices it needs, not so much to convince people on the other side. I, you know, there's part of me that, you know, yeah, I would love to convince people on the other side, but just as much I'm interested in getting people who already claim to be about something in the white community, people who claim to be against racism and claim to be on the side of the angels, so to speak, to actually demonstrate just how much they really are committed to it. I mean, it seems to me if we would mobilize ourselves, those of us who claim to be about something, it wouldn't matter if we converted the others. You know, it really, the choir, frankly, might be sufficient if we're actually singing, you know. But the problem is sometimes, you know, the choir sits there and there might be a whole row that isn't singing because they don't think they sound good, and they're just trying to, like, hide in the midst of everybody else, you know. So if we're all singing, then we might be able to really change the status quo, but I'm afraid that for many of us, we sit back, you know, and that really has to stop.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And I really like how you sort of state your intentions initially, that that you are including yourself in
right.
in the we,
yeah.
and that you're driven by love.
Yeah.
And also, the way you write it, it might be Dear White America, A Letter to a New Minority, but the other, you know, the people that are not white or not a part of the new minority or part of the new majority, you know, also feel that they can also listen in and also participate in this conversation because the way it comes out is as if we don't start rethinking the way we think about race, the institutionalizing of race as a way to structure policies and privilege, then the demise of our nation is quickly at hand, so to speak. I mean, we're not going to last much longer if it continues this way. So if you could talk about sort of your love of our nation and what drives you to write these type of books and to spend your life, you know, basically recently, I mean, not your whole life, but, you know, these books are, I mean, you have a crusade going here.
Well, you know, I mean, I've been at it in some capacity for 22 years.
Yeah. Is that like half your life or something?
Yeah, a little more than half. Yeah.
Okay.
More than half. Mm-hmm. And, So I don't know if it's a crusade or if it's just, I'm fortunate that I, you know, was able to figure out what it was I really cared about early. And I think a lot of people, sadly, in our culture don't figure out what they care about or what they're good at or what they are passionate about ever, let alone in their early 20s. So I was fortunate in that regard. I think it's hard to explain to people when you're issuing pretty trenchant critiques of something that you do it out of love. I think particularly for my fellow, you know, white Americans, they're very reluctant to believe that anything like the things that I say could come from a place of love. We've been so conditioned to believe that if we condemn the country's politics, if we condemn the country's systemic culture, that it's out of hatred. You know, we even have a word for it in our country, right? We call it un-American. It's a word that doesn't have any parallel, if you think about it, in any other country, right? Like if you were in Sweden and you were criticizing something the government or the culture or the people of Sweden did, is there even a word for that? Do we say, well, that's un-Swedish? Like, that word doesn't even exist, right? Because in our country, in the United States, right, we have this sort of grand national narcissism that makes us think that we're above reproach. All the things that we condemn people for criticizing in our own country, we praise them for criticizing in other countries. We call them, you know, patriots, in fact, in other countries when they stand up against their government. When the people of China stand up against their government at Tiananmen Square in 1989, we call them heroes, you know. When people in other countries do it, we call them heroes. And we do it in our country, we call them traitors. So there's that element, which is a national level. And then, of course, you add to that the racial, right? And for white folks, criticizing white racism ends up being heard as condemning white people, which is really sort of ironic. And I sort of try to talk about that both in this book and in White Like Me as well, that there's an irony to that. If you say that being against white racism makes you anti-white, then by definition that would mean that the only way that you could be pro-white people or love white people is to endorse white racism. I mean, you know, by definition it sort of makes white people and this vicious racism synonymous, and I don't happen to feel like white folks are inherently racist. I reject that notion. I do think we live in a culture of racism and an institutional racist reality that bends each of us and warps us into people who have internalized our notions of racial supremacy. And so it's precisely because I resent that having been done to me. I resent it being done to my two daughters. I resent it being done to my friends and you know, white colleagues. And it's a horrible thing to have happen. And I think that one rejects that and responds to that out of love, not hatred. If I didn't care for those individuals called white, I wouldn't waste my time on working, struggling with us, myself included, the way that others struggled with me. I'd just walk away from the whole thing and not worry about it, you know. But we don't really have that option because, as you said, and as I try to point out in the book, we're really coming up against a time crunch where if we do not figure out how to engage in solidarity across racial lines, the culture is really not economically, politically, socially going to survive for any number of reasons that I go into, the most obvious of which is you know, that you just can't sustain a healthy society if 50% of your population, the 50% which is of color, is 2 times more likely than the white half to be out of work, 3 times more likely to be poor, 9 years less life expectancy, 1/20th the net worth, you know, double the rate of infant mortality, double the rate of low birth weight kids. I mean, that's just not a recipe. You can't have a nation that's you can have one that's numerically divided, but it can't be that divided in terms of the opportunity structure and expect to maintain a healthy economy for anyone, white, black, or otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And then you sort of demystify, or you take, like, there's a mythology sort of floating around in our national consciousness around certain things like imprisonment,
yeah,
and education, equal education, equal opportunity, that the numbers don't support, as well as over time how things have changed, particularly, and I found it really interesting when you were talking about the prison system and how it went from being more, you know, white people incarcerated, more white men incarcerated, to now, you know, sort of the current numbers. That was really interesting. And then, you know, you talk about the privatization of, you know, public education, and, you know, as well as, you know, as you already mentioned, so the economic opportunity, and how, you know, that diminishes quite a bit more when one doesn't have proper education or access to good education, and one might have, you know, a criminal record.
Right.
It's like, oh, you just forget all that, and sort of, and this is sort of like a big statement of some, like, so piling it on here because we don't have that much more time. But you know how you start out talking about the 4th of July, and you talk about the historic nostalgia,
right,
you know, coupled with historic amnesia.
Right.
And I'm sure you're probably aware of a lot of sort of artists and other conscious, you know, white folks that are trying to undo the damage and trying to educate, or maybe, you know, sort of take the choir into these different rooms for rehearsals, like Dan Hoyle's Real Americans, which is back at the Marsh,
yeah,
in San Francisco. And I just met this poet at June Jordan's Poetry for the People's 20th Anniversary this past weekend, Ariel Lucky.
Yeah,
and yeah, and he's got the Searching for White Folks Soul.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, like you say in the book, and I just mentioned a couple of folks, you know, that you're not alone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, I think, look, there have always been, and I try to make this point in the book, too, near the end, there's been a tradition, an alternative, underappreciated, underexplored tradition of white allyship going back literally 400 years to the colonial period in this country, and really even before that, but in Europe. But here, all the way back to the colonial period, white folks whose names we don't learn in school, who stood up against the genocide of indigenous people, stood up against the enslavement of African people, stood up against the theft of half of Mexico in a war of aggression that the United States started on false pretense, stood up against the conquest and ravaging of the Philippines, stood up against every single racist incursion made in, within or abroad by this country. And I'm wanting white folks to connect to that tradition, because I do realize, you know, that when you tell people that the identity they have is a toxic one and that whiteness is a real problem in the world, obviously you're going to have to give them something, you know, to replace that with. People don't appreciate having their identity taken from them, and then you give them nothing. And so what I'm arguing is, look, you have an option. You don't have to connect to whiteness as you've done. There's this alternative tradition of allyship, of cross-racial solidarity. If you're willing to explore it, if you're willing to notice the bravery of it and join and connect with it, you can join this tradition, this long line of white folks, however much longer we wish it were, who have stood up and who have tried to live differently in this skin. And that's a choice we have to make. We have agency. We have free will in this regard. We don't have to be oppressors. Whiteness, white people are not inherently oppressive people, but we live in a system that unfortunately has turned us oftentimes into that, just like men don't have to be inherently sexist, right? It's something which a patriarchal culture does and inculcates in men, but we have options, and I try to get us to explore those options in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my closing questions, I have two, are, has the response to this particular book been different from your others, and if so, in what way, or how has this response been different? And secondly, was this book easier or harder to write than the others?
Well, it was definitely easier than the others in the sense that it could pretty much leap out of my skull fully formed without having to sit there and parse the theory and the analytical material that I did for Colorblind, which, again, I mean, it has its value, too. But this was easier, I think, in that regard. As far as the response, I mean, the reaction has been quite similar. You know, each of my books touches a different part of an audience. You know, White Like Me and this one, I think, touch that part of the audience that is looking for that more personal element. Yes, they appreciate the analytical as well. They appreciate the argumentative and the polemic, but it's that personal touch. And then all the books in between, Between Barack and a Hard Place, Colorblind, Speaking Treason Fluently, those touch maybe different portions of the audience. There's so many different folks out there who are interested in this for different reasons. So I think, you know, each of the books sort of serves its own purpose, and I would say the reactions have been similar for each, but maybe from different people. Like, the people who really get into Dear White America might be a slightly different group than what would get into Colorblind, but I think in the long run it all serves the same purpose, and I think the more readers that can be brought in to think about these issues who maybe are into reading different kinds of books, you know, the better. And so the reaction's been great. I think people like the brevity of the book. It's very readable. You can read it in easily in a day if you had the time, or 2 days at the most if you wanted to, and get, I think, a lot out of it. And so I think people are appreciating that.
Mm-hmm. Right. And do you have time for, like, one more?
Sure.
Okay. I forgot to mention, I have it here. I was just writing down some notes, like, oh, yeah, Occupy Movement.
Yeah.
And we have an election. So the timing is just perfect, you know, that you would come out with this letter. In the form of a book. And I was wondering if you could, I don't know if you were thinking about the Occupy movement, because I don't know if it was happening.
Yeah, as I was finishing it, it had not started yet.
And it's
sort of unfortunate, because that always happens. You know, you're in the middle of a book and you're just about done with it, and you send it to the publisher, and then something big happens that you think, oh, man, I wish I, you know, could have put that in. I've written a few other things elsewhere about it, blog posts and such, and I've talked about it in speeches. And I think that, you know, it's an interesting thing, because on the one hand, obviously, look, any movement that raises these issues of vast wealth disparity in the country is a good thing, and it's had a positive impact, I think, on the narrative. On the other hand, and this is not only my critique, I mean, there are some pretty significant problems with this movement in terms of how it does or does not approach and address race. I think, with the exception of the organizers in Oakland, who I think have done a far better job of blending a race analysis into the class analysis, and even there's work to be done. But I think Oakland sort of stands out as a group that's done that. In New York and elsewhere, it's been done, but in fits and starts, where you have a handful of activists who very clearly, I think, see the need to have a strong anti-racist analysis and really bring these issues in. And so they're the folks who have connected with Occupy Harlem, and they're the folks that have, you know, done Occupy the Hood, and the folks who have gone up and protested police brutality in Harlem in particular, and in the Bronx, and a few other places. But across the country, I don't see that as much, and that's going to have to happen. I mean, unless these white left activists come to understand the role that white supremacy has played in keeping the country economically divided. So, for instance, you can't really understand the vast income and wealth disparities and the cutting of social programs and the difference between the haves and have-nots in America unless you understand the way that racism has helped perpetuate that. That is central to the analysis, as I try to explain in this book. And so I think Occupy folks, white Occupy folks, are really going to need to connect to that. And we're going to have to be very careful when we use a narrative like, you know, the one versus the 99, because if we understand racism, and for that matter, if we understand sexism and straight supremacy and all these other systems of oppression, we know that the 99%, they ain't really living the same. You know, to be in the top 5 is way different than to be in the bottom third. To be in the top 25 is way different than to be in the bottom decile or 10%. So it's nice to craft this narrative of solidarity for 99% of the population, but come on. If you're at the 2% mark or the 3% mark, your life is nothing like the person in the bottom 20%. And to pretend that it is, just because you're not the very pinnacle of the owning class, for the sake of solidarity, I think could create some real problems down the line, because there are some very different lifestyles and cleavages that exist between people because of racism, because of sexism, because of straight supremacy, even within that 99%. And for that matter, there are some different class cleavages that exist there. So it's not that we don't use that narrative, but we just have to be very careful. You cannot create solidarity with a slogan. You know, you can only create solidarity by really building the relationships across racial lines, gender lines, sexuality lines, and even different class lines within that 99% if you want to actually move us forward. And so hopefully, you know, that will become part of the Occupy awareness and the Occupy narrative, but we're going to have to wait and see, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I went to Occupy San Quentin on February 20th, and in one of the messages that some of the incarcerated persons who had sent messages out to be read to the those gathered said that, like, you know, you talked about the bottom, well, they're the bottom of that bottom.
Yeah, right, right, mm-hmm. right. I mean, they're in the 99, but come on, they're not living like people in the free world, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
right, exactly.
That's a huge difference, right? And mm-hmm. and so we've got to be just very transparent about not presuming that it's as simple as the 1%, and to be perfectly honest, even the 1% is not a unified group. I mean, to be in the top 0.1% means you're living a way different life than people even at the lowest part of the one. Granted, anyone in the one is doing well, but some, even within the one, are living like, you know, like lords of the manor, so to speak, and others are still, relative to them, not nearly in the same position. You know, you could be at the 1% level based on your actual work that you do, earned income perhaps, but you can't be at the top 0.1% if you just based on your own labor. You can only get there based on your exploitation of the labor of others, really. I mean, you have to be a member of the owning class who makes your money from the money you already have from interest, and that's a very different life, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if you are aware that, April 17th is the 40th anniversary of Angola 3. And there's going to be these international actions. And then there's going to be a march on Washington, or get on the bus to Washington, for Mumia Abu-Jamal just a week later. And just wondering if, you know, sort of your thoughts around, you know, these mobilizations around these I guess more public cases of imprisonment, and then the second question was about this election year and how you know your books, Dear White America, Letter to a New Minority, because you mentioned the Tea Party, you know, early on in your book, could help people think differently about democracy and the office of president, as well as some of the legislation that's being pushed both locally and federally this year.
Well, taking those in backward order, I hope that the book and the narrative the book tries to put forward will certainly help people interrupt this nostalgia process that
mm-hmm.
that at least you know, one political party seems fully enthralled to, and there are even members of the other who are far too, I guess, solicitous of it. I mean, there's this battle right now within the country, and it's not just a battle about policy, because unfortunately, you know, the differences between the two parties at the level of policy oftentimes are relatively minimal. In some areas, they might be significant, but overall, both parties are completely enthralled, of course, to big money, and far too enthralled to Wall Street, regardless of what they might say. But really, the battle is not so much between these two parties as it is these larger grand assumptions about the country. And on the one side, you know, we have people who are very openly sort of pining away for the America of old. I mean, they say they want their country back. And I assume that when they say that, they aren't just saying, you know, we want to go back to like the day before Obama was elected, or 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, because frankly, the country wasn't doing all that well then for most people. But I assume that they're talking about something quite a bit further back than that. I mean, if you think about the white folks who were saying they want their country back, it's not 27-year-olds, you know, who were just saying, gosh, I'd like to go back to the days of my senior prom. You know, these are old people, by and large, older than, let's say, mid-50s to early 60s, who are talking about going back to a time, really, whether they're thinking of it or not in these terms, that's before the civil rights movement, that's really at a time when they thought America was a really innocent, lovely place. And, of course, it was a horrible, vicious and terroristic place for millions of peoples of color, and it wasn't that great for a lot of white folks either, to be honest. It wasn't great for most white women who still didn't have equal opportunity, even remotely close. It wasn't such a great time for LGBT folks who were white. It wasn't such a great time for working class and low-income white folks. But we have this nostalgic mythology, and it's very dangerous. I mean, nostalgia in any country is dangerous because it threatens to bring back a period of entrenched hegemonic domination by a few who feel like they're losing control of their country, and they'll do anything to get it back. That's very dangerous. So I hope that this book will help interrupt that narrative and get us to really think about what it's going to take to move forward, because that's what we have. We have one group that's saying we want the country back, which is a directional reference to the past, and then there are some of us who are saying, wait a minute, we can't go back. We have to look forward. What is that going to look like, and how do we get there? As far as the issue with incarceration and particularly high-profile cases like the Angola 3, like Lumia and others, I think that, you know, on the one hand, it has been, and I think I was somewhat cynical about this many years ago, or if not cynical, skeptical of the value of highlighting particular cases of particular prisoners, particularly when those prisoners were at least in part, if not in whole, incarcerated because of their political identities. I used to think that that wasn't going to really move the ball forward in talking about incarceration in the larger justice system because it was too limited to an individual case or the case of a handful of people. And I've come to appreciate how valuable it's been in many ways, because when you can put human faces on those who have been unjustly incarcerated, whether it's these cases or any number of others, as you think about the, you know, several hundred people now who have been exonerated from death rows around the country, whose stories, we don't all know their names, but we've certainly heard these stories, and it seems like there's another story every couple of weeks coming out. When you get to know their personal stories, it does have a profound effect on our consciousness. It humanizes the incarcerated. You know, it means more to know the name of an incarcerated person than it does to know that there's, you know, a couple million people under lock and key right now. Like, that number, you know, just doesn't register with people the way that a human face, a human name, a human story does. So I think that the value of this in the last 30 or 40 years, really talking about particular cases. And really, this goes all the way back probably to, you know, the unjust trials for Huey Newton and Angela Davis and others in the Panther movement, and for Angela, of course, as the head of the, for a while, lead person within the Communist Party and one of our great, you know, activists in our country's history. Those unjust political trials of people.